I forgot how busy it can get around here at the old radio ranch. Ken Sherb for Todd Wilkin on Issues, etc. And we've got stuff backed up from last half hour. Before we get to that, let me give you an idea of what we're going to be doing this final hour of the program for today, January 23rd, 2006. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have Dr. Uwe Simonetto from Concordia Seminary talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The 100th anniversary of whose birth is coming up. And in just a moment, we'll be continuing our series on the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month with Dr. Joel Heck, the author of that book. The book is about C.S. Lewis on education. It's entitled Irrigating Deserts, and we'll be talking about C.S. Lewis as a student today, because every teacher has to start by learning something. I was in the middle, however, of telling you about the retreats coming up in the spring at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. If you would like to learn more about those, look for their logo on our homepage, issuesetc.org, or give Concordia Theological Seminary a call, 1-800-481-2155. That's 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Ask them about their spring retreats for lay people. Dr. Joel Heck is the Vice President of Academic Services at Concordia University in Austin, Texas, and he is the author of our Book of the Month, Irrigating Deserts. It's about C.S. Lewis on education. Joel, welcome once again to Issues, Etc.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
C.S. Lewis was obviously a brilliant man. Just about all of us have seen or read something that he has done. But I suspect that before he was a brilliant professor and writer, he was a brilliant student. What made him a brilliant student?
How many answers to that question do you want? I can think of several.
Go ahead and give me the top three or four.
Well, I think his parents set the stage for that with the kind of home that they had, a home that was filled with books. There's a very famous quotation in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, about all the books that there were in the home, books everywhere. He says books, some that were appropriate for young children and books definitely not. But he also says that nothing was forbidden him. So here is a young man early in life who was reading voraciously, and apparently because he was simply gifted by God with a great mind, remembering most of what he read. This is a boy who at the age of 9 read John Milton's Paradise Lost. So that's fairly impressive.
Mm-hmm.
So though his parents never read to him, which is something that a lot of parents do today and I think is a really excellent way of helping to get your young children an early start, they had a nurse in their home, since a lot of Irish families did have staff, cooks and cleaners and people of that sort that would work at low wages for some of the more wealthy families. They had a nurse by the name of Lizzie Endicott who read to the Lewis boys, both C.S. Lewis and his older brother Warren. I think that was one of the early factors that helped shape his life.
Well, let's kind of dwell on that one a little bit now that you bring it up. Obviously, as you say, the resources were there for him to learn. He was actually read to by at least someone in the house. His parents were educated people too, though, and I would imagine that he caught something of what it meant to be a dweller in the house of intellect from them.
He did very much so, though he later on in his life had his difficulties with his father, especially after his mother died when he was 9. He did receive or inherit some natural gifts from his father as well as his mother. His father was a lawyer, practicing lawyer, and a college graduate. His mother was likewise a college graduate, a graduate of Queen's University in Belfast, which I did have the opportunity to visit about a year and a half ago and see the place where she went to college. But so they were both educated people, and the mother suggestion from the things that I've read is that Lewis inherited her logical abilities because she earned a college degree in logic and mathematics, and that he inherited more of the imaginative side. If we think of people being left-brained and right-brained, one or the other usually predominates. He inherited a lot of the right-brained gifts of his father, who was, in addition to being a lawyer, was a fairly gifted public speaker and a member of a literary society in Belfast. So he got some gifts from both parents, and perhaps his God-given abilities to bring both the left brain and the right brain together in a lot of his writings is what, more than anything else, has created a legacy for him that lives on to this day and shows no signs of fading away.
I think that's a terrific point, Joel. Now, I've got a point that may not be quite so terrific. It's from your book. I don't think it's from the section that we're talking about today, though. And I've got the uncomfortable feeling of looking for something and not being able to find it. I think you'll probably recognize it, though, pretty readily. It was Lewis or someone else that Lewis knew was talking about why a student goes to a really first-rate school, whether that be at the secondary level or the collegiate level. And the idea was you don't go so much for the knowledge, but you go for the habits and the cast of mind that you get there. And it sounds to me like Lewis's matriculation eventually onto Oxford as a student was really a continuation of the kinds of habits and cast of mind he already got in the home.
I think that's fair to say that. There were times when his education wasn't of the highest quality, especially early in his life, but he really thrived on that kind of education that did train him in the habits of mind. You may be referring to a quotation by Edward Edmonds, who was citing a master from Eton back in the late 19th century about the whole purpose of education at Eton or at the university. Or even you may be thinking of what Lewis said was the purpose of education, that is to produce a good citizen. And you may even be thinking about The Abolition of Man, Lewis's philosophical work, which defends natural law, and wherein Lewis says the head rules the belly through the chest, and he talks about the importance of trained emotions that he sees sort of metaphorically resident in the chest, but the belly being the passions and the head, of course, being the reason that needs to tell some of its moods where to get off.
505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727 are our phone numbers. Again, 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. This is Issues Etc. We're talking with Dr. Joel Heck about C.S. Lewis and his student days. Okay, outside of Lewis's family, what else made him a really excellent student?
The fact that he was a reader, we've touched on that, and his family setting him up for that, his natural talents, his ability to absorb and to remember the things that he read. We talked about on the previous radio interview with 2 weeks ago. But another thing that's true of Lewis is that he was very much a self-starter. He was a person who took charge of his own education, and to illustrate that, I would take us to the time that he was living with a private tutor, W.T. Kirkpatrick, just outside of London, and he had just arrived at Kirkpatrick's home, and the first day, Monday after that weekend when he arrived, he was to start studying Greek, and he had had some Greek but not Attic Greek, and so he thought Kirkpatrick would start him off with some lessons on the difference between the different styles of Greek, and Kirkpatrick didn't do that at all. Kirkpatrick read about 20 lines of Greek in the new dialect that he had never heard before, and then he translated those 20 lines with very few explanations, and he went beyond those 20 lines. He read 20 and he translated about 100, and then he gave Lewis a lexicon and said, go through as much of those 100 lines as you can, and left the room. Now, most people would wilt under a challenge of that sort, but Lewis said that Kirkpatrick's style of teaching was like red beef and strong beer. I mean, he really relished it. And later in life, he used to say that if he could have his way and schedule his day as an academician the way he wanted it to be, it would be very much like it had been when he was studying with Kirkpatrick between 1914 and 1917.
Of course, Lewis was trained in the classic English system, and particularly at the university level, that's, to this day, a very different kind of university education than people in this country are accustomed to. Could you tell us just a little bit by way of background about the English system, both as Lewis encountered it and how that may still endure today?
Certainly. I will be talking particularly about Oxford and Cambridge, where the tutorial system is in existence and not necessary. It's not in existence in the so-called red brick universities in the UK, a lot of which are much newer than Oxford and Cambridge, those being two of the earliest universities ever established in the world. But the heart of education at Oxford University then and even today is the one-hour tutorial that a student will have with a fellow, that is a faculty member in a given discipline, and the tutorial will begin with a paper that has been written by the student, perhaps 20 or 30 minutes in length, and following the presentation of that paper, which is based on reading and research the student has been doing for the past week, then the fellow will critique that paper. And after 20 minutes or so of critique and dialogue, not just one-way critique, not just monologue, but dialogue also, usually one-on-one, but sometimes there would be a second or a third student there, then the fellow will assign the readings for the next week and the paper that the student should prepare for 1 week hence. And so in the intervening time between those two tutorials, the student will be on his own or her own. They do have women at the university now, even though they resisted that very much in the 20th century. I believe between Oxford and Cambridge, the last college, which was at Cambridge, admitted women only in 1988, if I remember correctly. But Oxford, the colleges of Oxford, got on board that more quickly. But in the intervening week, or the period of time between the tutorials, the student will study up just in that area, and it might be studying Shakespeare and reading in Shakespeare widely and reading a lot of other 16th century literature that would support the study of Shakespeare.
And so in effect, the student has a term paper every week.
Yes. And the student is, in most of the programs, is studying one subject area. When Lewis was taking his second degree in English language and literature, that was the only subject he was studying. He wasn't taking four or five courses at a time. He was focusing on the length and the breadth of one particular discipline, and that was, in a sense, it's a twofold discipline, English language and English literature, the two being very closely related, of course. So a very different kind of system, and in English language and literature, you study just that subject area for 3 years. You don't also take math and religion and biology and speech and so many other classes like we do typically in an American institution.
And yet, as you note in the book, by way of the range of different degrees, three of them in total, that Lewis took, he got what we might call a fairly decent liberal arts education.
Yes. His first degree in honor moderations and greats was more wide-ranging. First 2 years, roughly, of his undergraduate education, he studied Greek and Latin texts, and it wasn't just the translation of Greek and Latin. There was more to it than that. He did have to take an examination in Holy Scripture, for instance. And then the second half of his degree, which the entire degree, it took him about 3.5 years, he did honor moderations, which was ancient history and philosophy. So between those 3.5 years of study, it wasn't just entirely the study of philosophy, as his second degree was entirely the study of English, but he got Greek, Latin, philosophy and history during those 3.5 years of study. And you add that together with his second degree, and you have the core, really, of a liberal arts education in the United States today.
Now, Lewis was a great devotee of reading the great books and reading the actual great books, not just secondary sources written about them. Apparently, he picked up that kind of a love already at this point, right?
He did. Many of his students will talk about how he had a much greater appreciation for primary literature rather than secondary literature. So he wanted students to read those primary sources in their preparation. And the only reason he thought that students ought to read some criticism would be to enable the student to know what kinds of areas of study of a given author, a Milton or a Shakespeare or a Chaucer, have already been pretty well settled in the subjects that they can steer clear of. But he didn't really want people to be dependent upon what other people said about this author. He wanted them to think for themselves, which is a pretty important thing for any student in higher education or beyond to be doing, to think for yourself.
One of the authors whose great books Lewis obviously was highly familiar with was the Greek philosopher Plato. And you write, Joel Heck, in the book that Plato's influence can be seen in this comment by Lewis. And I think, by the way, you're absolutely right, but I want you to talk about this a little bit more. Lewis said, "I think that all things in their way reflect heavenly truth, the imagination not least." Would you talk about how that reflects Plato in Lewis's thought and the general role of Plato in Lewis's thought?
Plato had this idea of forms, believing that everything that exists in this world has an ideal counterpart in the next world. And so where you might see a tree or a chair here in this world, you will see only a representation of the ideal, and none of those chairs or trees that we see will be the ideal, but that they are simply a copy of the ideal tree or chair or building or person or something else in the next world. And so that idea, Lewis, for those who have seen the movie or the play version of Shadowlands, will recognize when he talks about this world being only shadows. And it kind of reminds me of what Paul says in Romans 8 when he says the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing to the glories that shall be revealed to us.
Well, that gets to the point, by way of you quoting that Bible passage, to the issue that I wanted to bring up, which is Lewis's attachment and affinity to Plato and his thought as a Christian thinker. Over the years, a lot of Christian thinkers like St. Augustine have been very much attached to Platonic ideas, and sometimes that has helped them in their exposition of the Christian faith. Sometimes it has hurt them in their exposition of the Christian faith. Was Lewis helped or hurt by his obvious love for Plato when it came to his exposition of the faith?
I have to believe that it helped him significantly. When he was studying philosophy, he was not a Christian. He had declared himself to be an atheist at about age 16, and then he went to live with Kirkpatrick, who, though he was a wonderful man in many ways, did describe himself as an atheist. But Plato's idea or doctrine of forms, I think, helped Lewis to understand that there is another world beyond the material world. And that whole concept is something that he really powerfully represents in the Chronicles of Narnia. And, of course, we know the first of those stories is now on the movie screen for people all over the world to see. And perhaps one of the better parts of that entire seven-book series of the Chronicles of Narnia is in the very last book, The Last Battle, where the Narnia that the four Pevensey children had known passed away, and they die in a train wreck, and they end up in a Narnia that is even better than the Narnia that they had known. And I think that's going to happen for us, too. We may call it a new heavens and a new earth, but I think that the eternity that we're going to experience will have some similarities to the life that we're experiencing now, but we really can't say much more than that. Heaven is so often described more in terms of what's not there than what is there.
Might I say then that we will be surprised by joy?
I think you're correct there, very much so, yes.
Lewis obviously did, though, imbibe to his great benefit and to those of his students, or to that of his students, a lot more than just Plato. Who were some of his other favorite authors?
Well, he did have a few favorite contemporary authors, G.K. Chesterton being one of them. Chesterton's Everlasting Man is one of the books that really helped Lewis along the way towards becoming a Christian. And other contemporaries, he liked Dorothy Sayers' writings and Charles Williams. But he did very much enjoy and appreciate George MacDonald, a 19th century Scottish author whose book Fantasties, Lewis said, baptized his imagination. He loved John Milton and wrote a book entitled A Preface to Paradise Lost. He wasn't that great a lover of theater, for when he wrote his book in the Oxford History of the English Language, he wrote English language in English literature in the 16th century, excluding drama. But he did attend plays from time to time and did appreciate Shakespeare, particularly his poetry. He liked John Donne. He liked George Herbert. He had a wide range of authors that he liked. He liked Chaucer very much. And there are others. I could go on.
Well,
those are a few.
Unfortunately, our time is failing us. We've been talking about C.S. Lewis as a student, part of our ongoing discussion this month of the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month, Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education, with Dr. Joel Heck, the author of the book. Joel is the Vice President of Academic Services at Concordia University in Austin, Texas. Joel, what's the last part of this going to be about?
We're going to take a look at how Lewis functioned as a teacher, as a fellow. Did he actually put into practice his teaching philosophy? And what was it like to be a student sitting at the feet of C.S. Lewis?
Okay, that's coming up next week with Dr. Joel Heck and Todd Wilkin, who will be back at the mic already this week on Thursday. Thank you, Joel. You can purchase, by the way, Irrigating Deserts, our book of the month, by calling Concordia Publishing House. You can call them tomorrow at 1-800-325-3040. That's 325-3040. The book costs $22.99 plus shipping and handling. Again, it's 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. That's issuesetc.org. The book entitled Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education, the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January is available in a little specimen there for your inspection. Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about yet another important Christian figure of the 20th century. In this case, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian. We'll have Dr. Uwe Simonetto of Concordia Seminary, the director of the brand new Institute on Lay Vocation. He has written an article that will appear in a forthcoming edition of the Lutheran Witness called Welcome Back, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe continues to score big at the box office. But what do we know about the author of The Chronicles of Narnia? How did C.S. Lewis's formative years help create this great writer, thinker, and educator? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January is Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. This new book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or find out more about Irrigating Deserts on our website, issuesetc.org. What can modern education learn from the educational philosophy of C.S. Lewis? How important is it to shape both head and heart? Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education by Dr. Joel Heck. The cost is $22.99. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Irrigating Deserts, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January.
The Church, It needs a new reformation.
Answers with Ken Ham, a popular speaker on the creation versus evolution controversy. Ken, I hear many people calling for a revival in our nations, so why do you say we need a new reformation instead?
When you think very carefully about it, the great revivals of the past occurred when people understood they were sinners and that they needed to repent before a holy God. In other words, people had a fear and reverence for God and His Word. And when you look at nations today like England, in which great revivals occurred generations ago, there's very little vestige of Christianity left in public life now. The church, by and large, is dead, with only pockets of small Bible-believing churches struggling to make an impact on what's now a very pagan culture. And sadly, in such nations, most of the churches have compromised the Word of God, particularly in Genesis. Most of the church leaders believe in evolution and or billions of years. They don't and can't preach authoritatively from the Word of God like they used to. If we want to see revivals again in nations, I believe there has to be a new reformation in the churches first, with God's people returning to God's Word and accepting it as authoritative. This must begin with the church repenting of compromise and believing God's Word, beginning with Genesis.
If churches accepted the full authority of the Bible, then they'd also reject the dangerous belief that the earth is millions of years old. Discover more when you read our new free booklet on our website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
Here's Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Will Wheaton, on why you should support LCMS World Relief.
LCMS World Relief is so important because it gives flesh to the love that Christ commands us to have. I'm reminded of the words from 1 John, where the apostle wrote, "Little children, let us not love with word or tongue, but in deed and in truth." And when you support LCMS World Relief, that is precisely what you're doing. You're loving in deed and in truth. You're providing food for the hungry and shelter for the homeless and clothing for the naked. It's a way that the love of Christ is actually incarnate and touches these people's lives, and it's just a wonderful thing.
For more information about LCMS World Relief, look for their logo at our website, issuesetc.org, or call them, area code 314-996-1683. 314-996-1683. LCMS World Relief.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 1105 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We'll visit with Turner Stimson about a different approach to Alzheimer's care, and Carol Bungie, who's clinical coordinator for the palliative care program at Unity Health Home Care, will be our guest. She'll help us understand the difference between palliative care, hospice, and other inpatient programs. It begins at 1105, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
This is Issues Etc. live on this January 23rd. I'm Ken Sherb for Todd Wilkin. We are, by the way, here at Issues Etc., glad to have the underwriting of LCMS World Relief. To find out about their work around the world, you can look for their logo on our website. Look at the homepage at issuesetc.org. Or you can support the efforts of LCMS World Relief directly by calling them. The number is 1-800-481-2155. That's 1-800-481-2155, LCMS World Relief. Tomorrow on the program, well, let's see. Have you been watching TV lately? Have you seen this new thing, The Book of Daniel? I myself have not seen the program, but Dr. Gene Edward Veith has. We're going to be talking with Dr. Veith of World Magazine. Of course, he's a frequent guest here on Issues, etc. Cultural editor, I think he is, at World Magazine, and I wouldn't be surprised if he's not maybe even working on a piece for the magazine about this TV series that features an Episcopal priest and the ups and downs of his family life. And from what I've heard, he's got more subplots going there than you can shake a stick at. And every now and again, he gets a visit from this Jesus character. And you never know if this is a figment of his imagination or if the program is based on the premise that Jesus is actually appearing to him. Anyway, we will talk about that, sort it out, and get to the bottom of it with Dr. Gene Edward Veith tomorrow. Also tomorrow, we continue our series on
Eastern Orthodoxy with Dr. Gene Smith, who himself comes out of Orthodoxy and knows whereof he speaks, as it were, in the first person. And we're going to be discussing the subject of dispensationalism with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado. Dispensationalism was, probably very big, especially as we approached the year 2000 and people wondered, well, is this going to be the end right here? Are we at the end of the dispensation? Has the rapture occurred yet and am I still here? And what implications does that have? We'll talk about that all tomorrow with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller. In a few moments, we'll have Dr. Uwe Simonetto of Concordia Seminary, the director of the brand new Institute on Lay Vocation at the seminary, here to talk about Dietrich Bonhoeffer this coming February 4th, which will be, a couple of weeks, is the 100th birthday of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, born February 4th, 1906. Dietrich Bonhoeffer grew up in Berlin. He used to ride the streetcar, I am told, with the great historical theologian Adolf von Harnack, who was kind of a neighbor and family friend, into the university. Bonhoeffer was a brilliant student, got his first doctorate at the age of, 21, and his second doctorate not too long after that, and had a checkered career. It may have looked like the skids were greased for him to go into the German academic realm and prosper there as so many professors, brilliant minds had before him. But then along came the victory of the Nazi Party in the elections of 1933, and the whole life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer took on a very different turn, a very different cast indeed. The longer time went on, the more Bonhoeffer became convinced as a citizen that Hitler had to go. And finally he got involved in a plot actually to assassinate Adolf Hitler, and for his troubles was eventually arrested and incarcerated by the German authorities, and finally, just before the end of the war, he was hanged on, help me out, Uwe, April 9th, 1945.
1945, just before the...
Pull up to the mic here. Dr. Uwe Simonetto, let me introduce you formally, of Concordia Seminary, here to talk with us about Bonhoeffer, please.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned this very important point, which most people haven't understood, that Bonhoeffer was a martyr in the sense, not a martyr of the church, but the sense of a citizen, a Christian, as a citizen in the left-hand kingdom. He also opposed, of course, the Nazis in the church, and especially the Nazi attempt to eradicate Christian theology and Christian teaching, eradicate anything pertaining to Jews and Judaism, Old Testament, etc., pastors of Jewish origin from the church. He opposed that, but for that he would not have been hanged. He was banned from preaching, he was banned from writing and lecturing, but not that. He actually did precisely what he indicated when he left America shortly before the beginning of World War II. He wanted to be with his people, with the suffering Christians in this regime. He knew that the cross was waiting for him at the end. And he then said, when he got involved in the plans to assassinate Hitler, his friends asked him, well, is this not against the fifth commandment? And he said, yes, of course, all that may be true. But right now, as a citizen in this world, as a Christian in this world, he has to follow the dictates of reason, which demands that Hitler had to be removed. He saw himself as someone throwing himself into the spokes of a cart moving on an evil track. And then, of course, he'd still have to go to Christ for forgiveness' sake. He had to go to the right-hand kingdom for that. But he was hanged for his his actions as a Christian, as a traitor to his government, which he was, but of course it was an evil government.
Yeah, and so for his role in the conspiracy, he was finally hanged. I'm interested in the article that you have written for an upcoming issue of the Lutheran Witness about Bonhoeffer, in the fact that he insisted, Bonhoeffer did, on having his name removed from congregational prayer lists, where there were prayers being offered for pastors who were suffering persecution for proclaiming the gospel. Yeah. He said, I'm not suffering persecution for proclaiming the gospel.
Well, he meant it slightly differently. He said, I do not want these pastors to be thrown into the same pot with me, who is actually being punished and arrested for acting against the government. In other words, in a civil environment. He did not wish these pastors to be tainted with the same brush that he was, for being a, quote, traitor, unquote, to his own country and his own government, rightly or wrongly. So that was a very important message. The other important message was the other important fact is, of course, that he wasn't allowed to preach anyway, had not been allowed to preach or lecture or publish since very, very early in the Hitler years. He obviously worked as a theologian. He wrote in the prison cell until the very end. In fact, when he was in military prison, where he was treated extremely well, his warden, was a sergeant major, a very nice guy, obviously a Christian, smuggled actually his manuscripts out. So this is why we are now in possession of his magnificent writings. But that was what he did in jail. But he was in jail for treason, or as a suspect of treason. Mm-hmm. As long as he was in a military jail, he was okay. When he was then transferred to a Gestapo jail, that was a totally different matter, of course, and he was that after the assassination attempt on the 20th of July, 1944. By the way, when he was hanged, you see, there is this interesting story here that the doctor, the physician at Flossenbürg concentration camp told, and how touching it was, and how moving, how Christian this man was, and how lovable, and he knelt.
Oh, yeah, lots of people have heard about the composed way in which Bonhoeffer faced death, knelt down and prayed before he walked up to the gallows.
Yeah, and all this may have been actually a ruse. There was a witness there, a Danish diplomat, who said there were no gallows in that concentration camp, which meant there were no steps to move up to the gallows. There was no trap which would have facilitated an instant death or almost instant death. But we know that the other members of the German military intelligence, especially Admiral Canaris and General Oster, were slowly strangled to death, allegedly on piano wires. I think that was wrong. What happened was they had a flexible hook sunk into the wall, steel hook sunk into the wall, relatively low so that the tips of the victim's feet touched touched the ground. And the minute they touched the ground, the victim flipped up again, you see. And so these guys were slowly strangled to death. And it's according to this Dane, they were then revived, quite probably by the very doctor who claimed to have witnessed these fervent prayers.
Oh my!
Were revived to repeat over and over and over again the agony of dying. So actually,
I didn't think he was reviving them in their best interests.
No. It's just in order to torture them a little more. And it is very, very fierce. But the one thing that I'm trying to stress in this article, and also in a lecture that I'm going to give up at Concordia Seminary, Fort Wayne, is this. A lot of people have hijacked Bonhoeffer, claiming that he was the progenitor of godless Christianity, atheism even, God is dead movement. There's a very famous German evangelical called Schuntemann, who claims, well, Bonhoeffer wasn't Lutheran at all, but was actually a Reformed scholar, when in fact Bonhoeffer's end was the end of a man who lived a Lutheran life in the truest sense of the word.
You're the director of the Institute for Lay Vocation, and it would seem to me that Bonhoeffer would be an interesting case study for you, even though he wasn't a layman.
No.
But in this situation where he is acting as a citizen and sinning boldly,
right,
taking Luther's advice.
And he used that term.
Yeah, there you go. From Luther's advice to Melanchthon,
and
then repenting,
and then repenting, and throwing everything to the foot of the cross, as Lutherans say. But he said, you know, I am a bold sinner, I am a strong sinner, but I have to do this. In the left hand kingdom, we have to follow the dictates of reason, which God has given us to find our way around this world.
So you're using Bonhoeffer as a kind of a paradigm of having your head screwed on straight about God's right hand and left hand realms of governance.
Yeah, and not to be a hypocrite. I mean, you know, there are so many people. What always baffles me. There are so many people. Oh, how good Christians they are. However, they sing Amazing Grace on Sunday, and on Monday they go and have their child slaughtered. Or they sing Amazing Grace, but then of course divorce their wives, divorce their husbands, or whatever, or abandon their children. Bonhoeffer was very consistent in his Christian life, but he was prepared to sin because, as a good Lutheran, as only a Lutheran knows to that sense, we are still in an unredeemed world here, where the devil is very, very powerful indeed, and therefore we have this tool by which keep order in this left-hand kingdom, and that tool is reason.
We've got about 10 minutes with Dr. Uwe Simonetto talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the 100th anniversary of whose birth is coming up very soon here. Our telephone numbers, if you want to call in and ask a question, make a comment, are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. That's 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Oh, yes, and I'm Ken Sherb for the Vacationing Todd Wilkin. If you're just tuning in, we are live this January 23rd, so give us a call. Uwe, you were talking a moment ago over on the side of the Kingdom of the Right about the kinds of things that the Hitler government was doing to the church.
Right.
I'm not sure if that's really commonly known. You can talk to people who know a lot about World War II, a lot about the years leading up to it, but they may have no idea of what was going on in German Christianity at the hands of the Hitler government.
At the hands of the Hitler government and, unfortunately, unfaithful pastors who served the Hitler government. Not the majority, okay? There were about 18,000 Protestant pastors, mainly Lutheran, in Germany at the time. At its very worst period, the so-called German Christian movement, which was the pro-Nazi movement, numbered 6,000 pastors. And then there were at least 6,000 pastors in the opposing movement, the Confessing Church. And you had the other guys in between who were non-committal, but who certainly weren't traitors. I mean, I lived through that period myself, and I remember attending Sunday school and Sunday services and all these things. And
now, your church was, what was it like?
Well, very, very strange. My church was very confessional at the beginning. I remember that. Yes, there was, of course, an intercessory prayer for the government, as you would in any church, regardless who the government is. But there was no Nazi teaching until I was evacuated to the countryside, to the home of a German Christian pastor. My parents didn't even know this pastor was a German Christian. The guy beat me up, for example, for using French words, with which our language was laced at the time, you know, for things like a napkin or first floor, used etage or sub-basement and that sort of thing, sidewalk, all of which in German you have two expressions, one is German and one is French. And this guy preached the gospel of the Third Reich, the gospel of Hitler. But the interesting thing is, first of all, his church was always empty. The only people in his church during his Sunday services were his family, then those kids who were evacuated from the big city because of the bombing and had to stay in his house, and the local party chieftain and one or two other Nazis. That was it. When they had a pulpit exchange with a neighboring pastor who was confessing, even though he wasn't part of the confessing movement, but you had everybody and his mother in there, including the French and Polish prisoners of war who worked in the fields for us and who didn't have a Catholic church to go to. So they went to the Lutheran church listening to this guy's sermons because they knew they could trust him, you see. Mm-hmm. So you had these two things. Now, the pro-Nazi pastors were obviously anti-Semites. As I said, they wanted to strike anything referring to Christ's Jewish roots out of it, try to pretty much eradicate the Old Testament from Scripture. They one of the first things they did was to have pastors of Jewish descent, ethnically Jewish pastors, but of course Christians, taking off the clergy roster, which is precisely the first thing that got Bonhoeffer involved in the confessing movement, saying this is, of course, the absurdity. So that was that. But it's in the end, you see, the funny thing is the German Christians.
And the German Christians are the Hitler group.
The German Christian movement did not succeed. And although many American church historians claim, well, the German church, meaning not the Lutheran church in Germany in general, was wimpish, they tend to forget that if anybody raised his voice and anybody spoke up, if he was young enough to be sent to the front, he would be sent to the trenches at the Russian front. And this is where they were all killed, you see.
Well, and as you're suggesting here, the lay people knew what was going on.
My grandmother, who taught me to be a Christian, was a wonderful woman who, during the air raids, every night held me in her arms, singing Lutheran hymns into my ear, and she taught me how to pray. My grandmother would not go to her parish church throughout the war because the parish pastor was a German Christian, in quotation marks, and she called him, a wonderful Saxon expression, a lumich, which means a bastard, a swine. And she wouldn't go. She did all her devotions at home, lit a candle every morning, sang her hymns, said her prayers, got her family around her. And occasionally, when she could, you know, don't forget it wasn't very easy to travel in town when the town was being bombed, she would go to, say, St. Thomas's Church in Leipzig or St. Nikolai Church, which were clean, meaning not non-Nazi, for communion. But basically, she would do all her stuff at home.
Now, you're, again, the director of this new Institute for Lay Vocation. What kind of lessons do you draw from that experience, from seeing people like your grandmother, who, when they were growing up, could not have known that they would be in straits like these eventually? Yeah. But there was something about her education in the faith, something about her formation in the faith, that when the time came, she was willing, if necessary, to say her devotions by herself, pray her prayers, read her scriptures, and pray to Christ.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm going to be teaching a course on this matter in the spring quarter, a graduate course. The lesson is this. Or the lesson that we have to draw is, nobody can guarantee that something like this may not be for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's quite likely it will happen at one point, because America's enemies are numerous, and you might find yourself in terrible straits without oil, without gas, without this, without that, chaos, improper infrastructures, no vehicles, no shops. We have all that. You might find starvation. It is then that you will find that Christian upbringing, and proper Christian upbringing, not in a sort of theology of glory, everything is done, you don't have to do anything anymore, you're saved, or you go as to a mega church and have your ears tickled with bad music, and then you'll be fine. This is not what it is. My grandmother and Bonhoeffer and people like that will be able to teach, through transmission, of course, the Christians in the suffering America of the future on how to survive in their faith, how to keep their faith alive, and how to serve, that's the most important thing, how to serve others. My grandmother, in these horrible years of bombing and of starvation, when we were given 700 calories a day, that was all we could have under the Russian occupation, my grandmother helped others, served others. She was there for everybody, all her neighbors, and of course had an enormous impact on the lives of those who remembered her, and I'm the first one to testify to that.
We've got just about 2 minutes left in this interview, but I want to come back to something that you were mentioning before, and something you just mentioned, in fact, because you said Bonhoeffer himself could not have known growing up.
Yeah.
He actually led a fairly sheltered life and was a fairly pampered youth.
Upper class life, but with standards.
Yeah.
Wasn't pampered. I mean, you weren't allowed to be sloppy.
Yeah, not in the sense that he was degenerate, but just in the sense that he had a great deal of advantage that a lot of other youth in Germany did not have.
Yeah, but the advantage manifested itself in decent upbringing and education mainly. You know?
So now here he is with the advantage of being in the United States in 1939, in the summer, just prior to the outbreak of war, and people are at this point where they know war is going to come very soon, and he elects to go back.
He chose the cross. That's what he did. And that is the long and the short of it. He chose the cross. He knew where he was going, but he had to be with his people. He had to serve others.
Thank you very much. Fascinating interview, fascinating life, and one that we will probably continue to be talking about for quite a while. I'm glad this 100th anniversary of Bonhoeffer's birth is giving us a little incentive to do so. That's Dr. Uwe Simonetto from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. On the program tomorrow on Issues Etc., the usual smorgasbord of topics coming up ahead of us. We're going to be talking about things as varied as dispensationalism, Eastern Orthodoxy, the Book of Daniel, not the biblical Book of Daniel, but rather that new TV show, and we'll be talking with Dr. Gene Edward Veith, the culture editor for World Magazine, about that. Quite a wide range of stuff, but that's exactly what Issues Etc. is all about every week. Todd, by the way, will be back on Thursday with still more live programs. We are live again tomorrow. I'm Ken Sherb filling in for Todd. It has been a pleasure to be with you. Have a good, safe, and blessed night. We'll catch you back here at 3 o'clock for more of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.